The opinions expressed on all WRCA programs are those of the program producers and do not express the views of WRCA, its staff, or management. This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston, a Beasley Broadcast Group station.
The story you're about to hear is true. The model numbers have been changed to protect the collectors. It was cold and windy in Philadelphia. We were working the night watch on the most wanted desk. The boss is Captain James Skinner. My partner's name is Ramirez. My name is Bjersch. We were working on running down the 10 most wanted list of Philco radios. It was tough going. With a reputation for quality and innovation, especially in the early years, there was bound to be some disagreement as to exactly which models would be the most wanted. We had sorted through the line over and over again. We could still not nail down the list. We had a deadline to meet. The boss called Captain Skinner. He wanted to meet us at the corner of Tioga and C Street at 12 midnight. He said not to be late, to bring the list. We loaded the service van, rolled out to meet the captain. Our list better be good enough, or we'd wind up testing tubes in Scranton. We'd find out soon enough. We had nothing to do now but wait. I carry a multimeter. My partner carries a signal generator. We're with the Philco Factory Supervised Service Department. It's time for Tube Talk. George Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue by Freddie Martin. Thanks for tuning in to Tube Talk. You have reached the zenith of independently produced radio programming. This program is for radio collectors, music lovers, and those who enjoy good radio programming. Thanks for being with us tonight. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about us. If you'd like to reach us, we have an email address set up for the program, TubeTalk1, TubeTalk, the number one, at gmail.com. And, you know, Gershwin amazes me, and the reason I play that, I've played that song before on the program, but I've been working on a report with my son. He has to write a report for school about George Gershwin. And the more we read and looked up about Gershwin, and we're starting to put this thing together, it's the more amazing the guy becomes. You know, born into basically poverty in New York, a prodigy, taking piano lessons at the age of 10, plugging songs on Tin Pan Alley. He wrote Rhapsody in Blue, an American classic symphony, in 1924. I think he was in his 20s. An amazing character, truly American. And, you know, this is a quote, somebody reflecting on Gershwin. He felt, Gershwin felt, true music must reflect the thought and aspirations of the people in time. My people are Americans. My time is today. You know, and I look at this and I wonder, who's the Gershwin of today? Who's writing something in music today that we're going to reflect upon 70 years later and say, wow, that immigrant son or daughter, that they captured the essence, the zeitgeist, as Hegel would say, of that period in time. And, you know, I'm hard-pressed to come up with somebody who I could compare to Gershwin. And makes it all the more amazing, and it's a fascinating report. I'll let you know how the book report comes out, too. I would be remiss. We've got a couple of fairly significant radio events coming up here in the New England area. Number one, the New England Antique Radio Club is having a swap meet at the Westford Regency Hotel on Sunday, October 30th. From 8 a.m. to 12 noon, there will be no admission fee. There will be free parking. So let me repeat that. There will be no admission fee. So it's free, folks. You can come on in and walk around. This is a new format. Normally, they've charged admission, and it's also a new venue at the Westford Regency Hotel. Prior to this, we've had them up in Manchester, New Hampshire. So we're a little closer to Boston if you're in the Boston area. Come on out. Check out the radios. Meet the sellers. Meet the collectors. Meet the radio enthusiasts. It's a ground floor setup, no steps, and there will be a breakfast and lunch concession available. You pay for it. It's there at the Regency. They put on a great brunch. Secondly, Nearfest, the New England Amateur Radio Festival, is coming up in Deerfield at the Deerfield Fairgrounds in New Hampshire. This will take place October 14th and 15th, and this is a celebration of radio, vintage radio, ham radio. Focusing on vintage electronics, a lot of tube communication equipment will be up there. Sounds like a good group of folks putting it on, too. There'll be food, home-baked pies, all kinds of New England goodies, Polish-type food. Nobody goes home hungry, from what I hear. And you can check out their website at nearfest.com for more details. So with the nice fall weather here, if you're listening and you're in the Boston area, these would probably be a couple of very good takes and good entrees into the world of antique radio. We are pleased to have Ron Ramirez with us tonight. Ron is the author of Philco Radio from 1928 to 1942, as well as the proprietor of philcoradio.com. He is also a connoisseur of fine big band music, and just another reason we think he is a swell all-around radio guy here at Tube Talk. So we're going to do a little music and some commentary with Ron today, and a little later on we are going to talk about some radios. Imagine that. But we're going to do a little musical interlude here first, and so let's get right down to it. Glenn Miller, Moonlight Serenade, and from what you were telling me, Ron, this particular piece sort of changed the way you thought about music.
Absolutely, and Paul, before I begin, thank you for having me on your show once again. It's a real honor.
Very glad to have you.
Thank you, and yes, Moonlight Serenade, Glenn Miller and his orchestra, 1939. I was about 20 years old. This would have been a shame to give the year, 1980. That tells you how old I am.
Oh, you're just a kid. Anyway. Not bad at all.
Well, anyway, I was, I don't know, 19, 20 years old, I always enjoyed listening to hard rock, the harder the better. I had recently purchased a copy of the Beatles' White Album, and I'd sit and listen to, you know, stuff like Helter Skelter, and I was into Steppenwolf and a little bit of Kiss and things like that. That's all I wanted to listen to, you know, when you're young and you're male, it's basically what you're into even now. But I don't even remember now exactly where I heard this song. But the first time I ever heard Moonlight Serenade, it was like, you know, a revelation. I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is really amazing, beautiful music, very melodic. It was completely unlike anything I'd ever heard before. And from that point on, I changed my way of thinking as far as music was concerned. I became much more open to different types of music, and I remain that way to this time. I'll listen to just about anything except rap and one certain country artist that I won't mention.
You know, that's just taken on a life of its own, I got to tell you, because I saw a Texas rocker on the forum, and it comes back again. But, you know, I have to admit, you'll be disappointed. I do not have my Motorhead album with me for today. So we'll have to substitute with Glenn Miller. So let's listen to a little Glenn Miller and see what changed Ron's mind about music. Well, that certainly would be a nice way to end the day when you come home from work. Probably a little more relaxing than Metallica, huh, Ron?
Absolutely, Paul.
You know, and it's funny. My entree into this particular type of music is a little bit different than yours, but my folks were, you know, true greatest generation types, having, you know, grown up in the 30s and the 40s. And, you know, so they always had, you know, my father especially loved to play records, and we had this nice Magnavox, and he was always playing stuff. You know, I can remember as a kid, you know, I'd hear Jimmy Durante doing Inka Dinka Doo, and I'd hear Glenn Miller, I'd hear Artie Shaw, and, you know, some of the stuff I thought was funny, some of it I thought was corny, some of it was really very beautiful stuff. And so when I started to pick this up again a little later on in my 20s, it was kind of, you know, a lot of nice memories of my folks, too. But I said, gee, you know, this is why this stuff has lasted, because it spans the generations. So anyway, we've got a little Artie Shaw now, which is written by one of my favorite guys, Cole Porter. I love Cole Porter stuff. And why don't you give us a little background on Artie Shaw? He was had a very unique sound, and I was mentioning when we were chatting about doing the show, I had opened one of the shows with Fernisi, which is one of my favorites. But what do we know about Artie Shaw?
Oh, Artie Shaw was one of the greats when it came to the clarinet. He and Benny Goodman. But Artie Shaw was born in New York. His real name was Arthur R. Shawsky, and he was born in 1910. When he was 13 years old, he began to learn how to play the saxophone. And when he was 16 years old, he switched to clarinet. And he played in several different bands until the early 1930s, when he decided to quit the music business and buy a small farm in Pennsylvania. And in 1934, he returned to New York and returned to the music business as well. In 1936, he shortened his name from Arthur R. Shawsky to Artie Shaw, and he was leading his own band. Now, in 1938, Paul, Artie Shaw hired the great jazz singer Billie Holiday, and she didn't stay with the band very long, chiefly because audiences in the South weren't accepting of her.
Right, right.
Because she's African-American.
Yep, and color barrier is still there, yep.
Right, which, you know, these days, we look back on it and we see that it was silly. But,
right, right.
At that time, you know, a lot of people took that sort of thing very seriously. But anyway, she did record one memorable tune with Artie Shaw and his orchestra called Any Old Time. And in 1938, that same year, Artie Shaw recorded his biggest hit, which is a Cole Porter tune called Begin to Begin. And I believe that Artie Shaw's recording of Begin to Begin is the definitive version of the tune.
Well, you know what? Let's check that out if we've got things queued up here right, and we'll check that out. Here we go. Thank you. A very nice richness of tone, too. That's an excellent recording, wherever you you found that one, Ron. And I guess, you know, as we were swapping some information back and forth about what you'd like to play, Artie Shaw was another fellow who went off to join the service and started a band in the Navy, I think, too.
Yes, he did. He, after quitting music a second time and spending a little time in Mexico, he came back and reformed his band, and at the onset of World War II, he disbanded his civilian outfit and joined the Navy and led a Navy band in the Pacific Theater. And after the war, he went on to form different bands, large and small, including a little group he called the Gramercy Five, which he took that name from his home telephone exchange. And in 1954, he quit the music for good. And you know, Paul, Artie Shaw was, if you will, the last man standing among the big band leaders. He didn't leave us until 2004.
Well, God bless him. And gone, you know, an amazing legacy, too. And, you know, again, as I listen to some of this, it's funny. You know, obviously it sounds good here in the studio, but if I listen at home, and especially when you listen to some nice music like we're playing here tonight, and you listen to it on a nice old radio, I have to say the music really sounds nice, has a very different tone to it, and you know, it's a nice way to sort of connect back to the experience that somebody who was a radio listener in the 40s, early 40s would have. I'd just like to take a quick second here to remind everybody you're listening to Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, 1330 AM. And tonight, Ron Ramirez has joined us to talk about some music and to play some music, and eventually we'll get on to some radio talk, too. But we're sitting in the Philco parlor here. We've got the Model 90 warmed up, and I'm sitting in that big easy chair, the one the cat likes to scratch, and Ron is in the rocker, and we're just relaxing here to some very nice music. And the next one we're going to do here is it's a favorite in my collection. And, you know, these songs, some of these songs, especially just from around 1940, 41, that very early World War II era, have sort of a melancholy feel, sort of almost a longing feel. It's a sad period in time, and you can almost feel that through the lyrics and the music. So this one here is a version sung by Frank Sinatra with Dorsey, right, Ron?
Yes, it's Frank Sinatra with Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra, and yes, this song does have a melancholy feel to it, even though it's a rather peppy tune. It's a song that people would have danced to back in the day, and I suppose one who knows how to dance and still enjoys doing that sort of thing, along with big band music, could still do so. But, you know, I'd like to sort of steer away from the leaders and start talking about the vocalists now. Frank Sinatra, what can you say about Old Blue Eyes, the chairman of the board? Everyone knows he's from Hoboken, New Jersey. And, of course, at this time, he might have called him Young Blue Eyes, just a young skinny kid. He got his start in music as part of a singing trio in Hoboken called the Hoboken Four. And that group won a talent show, which was very big in radio in those days, Major Bowes Original Amateur
Hour. Yep, that's a very popular show, yep, and today, yep.
Yep, this was in 1935, and later that year, Sinatra left the Hoboken Four, and in the summer of 39, he became the male vocalist for the Harry James Orchestra, and only 5 months after that, he had the opportunity to leave Harry James and join Tommy Dorsey. And Harry James saw that it was a great opportunity for Frank, and he let him out of his contract. And during the period of time that Frank was with Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra, Frank would watch Tommy play the trombone, observe his breath control, and he used that to help him improve his singing technique. And if you don't know anything about Tommy Dorsey, you may not know that he had a brother named Jimmy Dorsey. And Jimmy was actually the older of the two brothers. And the two of them played in a number of bands when they were young, including Paul Whiteman's orchestra, before the two formed their own, the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra. And in 1935, Tommy walked out on Jimmy and the Dorsey Brothers band to form his own group. But the song we're going to listen to now is Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra with Frank Sinatra singing "I'll Be Seeing You."
Well, here we go. Here's Mr. Sinatra. Indeed, and moving on here, I was getting a little ahead of myself there. We've got some Jimmy Dorsey now, and why don't you tell us a little bit about this one, Ron? Change Partners is the name of the song.
I want
Yes.
His name was Bob Eberly, and these days, if you ask anyone about Bob Eberly, they'd say, Bob Eberly who? Is he one of the Everly brothers? Which, of course, he wasn't, and his name wasn't even spelled that way. It's Eberly with a B, not a V. No less an authority figure than Frank Sinatra himself once called Bob Eberly the greatest big band singer of them all. And I'm certainly not going to argue with that. Bob Eberly was the type of singer that you just don't hear these days. Today, it's modern popular music, a male vocalist, he's rapping some sort of crap that doesn't even make any sense and has no melodic value whatsoever. But anyway, Bob Eberly joined the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra back in 1935, and of course, a few months later, Tommy and Jimmy split up and went their separate ways, and Bob chose to remain with Jimmy. His vocals were so popular that he was encouraged several times to leave Jimmy and embark upon a solo career. However, Jimmy was good to Bob, and Bob was loyal to Jimmy, and he chose to remain with Jimmy until World War II. What's really unfortunate is after the war, Bob Eberly finally did embark upon that solo career, only to find that he'd been largely forgotten by the public. His last name was originally spelled E-B-E-R-L-E. He changed his spelling to E-B-E-R-L-Y, because radio announcers kept mispronouncing his name as Eberl instead of Eberl. Sure. George T. Simon, who's written books on Glenn Miller and other big band leaders, quoted Frank Sinatra as once saying this about Bob Eberly. The reason I started out on my own when I did, which was in 1942, was because I wanted to make sure I got there as a single before Bob Eberly did. I knew that if that guy ever did it first, I'd never be able to make it the way I did. That Eberly, he sang so rich and so pure, it used to frighten me. Even today, guys who sing in his fashion can't even sit in the same room with him. That guy's always been too much, and I knew he'd be too much for me if he ever got started on his own before I did. And Paul, you know, I've listened to a few different songs recently, including a later Glenn Miller recording with Skip Nelson singing lead, and you can tell that Skip is trying to imitate Bob Eberly.
Yeah, that's quite a tribute from Sinatra too. And a nice little story you had mentioned to me that apparently Sinatra was visiting Mr. Eberly towards the end of his life in the hospital, and apparently picked up all the expenses, and you know, it held him in such high regard, and seemed to be a pretty good pal of his. So that was a nice story too.
Oh, absolutely, Frank. Went to visit Bob as he lay dying in the hospital, and told him that he realized they'd never met professionally when they were singing with big bands. But Frank told Bob, "Don't worry about the hospital bills; it's taken care of."
Well, let's listen. And, let's listen in. Let's see how Mr. Eberly does his thing here on this one. See if we get this one going.
Must you dance every dance with the same fortunate man? You have danced with him since the music began. Won't you change partners and dance with me? Must you dance quite so close, with your lips touching his face? Can't you see I'm longing to be in his place? Won't you change partners and dance with me? Ask him to sit this one out, and while you're alone, I'll tell the waiter to tell him he's wanted on the telephone. You've been lost in his arms. Ever since, heaven knows when, won't you change partners, and then you may never have to change partners again. Change partners and dance with me. You've been locked in his arms ever since, heaven knows when. Won't you change partners, and then you may never have to change partners again.
What an easygoing vocal style, huh? I mean, it just sounds so natural singing that. And you know, I'll tell you who I think was listening to that, because I sense it when I listen sometimes to Dean Martin. I think he was copying this guy a little bit as well, sort of a very laid back, easygoing way of singing. And that was a nice version of that song. I like that quite a bit. And that's something you don't hear a lot, but you hear it here.
That is one of my favorite, all-time favorite big band songs right there.
And I guess from what you were saying, Jimmy Dorsey is a little bit easier going, a little bit more low-key than his brother, huh?
Oh, Jimmy and Tommy were like 180 degrees out of phase, if you will. Tommy was a hard-nosed businessman, very driven. Jimmy was very laid back, very easygoing, so it's easy to see why Bob wanted to be so loyal to Jimmy throughout the time that Jimmy had Bob singing with him.
Now, the next one we've got here is the White Cliffs of Dover, so why don't you give us a little background on that, and then we'll see how that one goes.
All right. The White Cliffs of Dover, one of the more popular tunes of the Second World War. And the particular version we're going to play is by Glenn Miller and his orchestra, with the vocal by Bob Eberle's younger brother, Ray Eberle. And when Glenn formed his orchestra, the one that became such a huge success, well, naturally, he wanted to hire Bob Eberle, Jimmy Dorsey's vocalist. And when he found out that Bob was unwilling to leave Jimmy Dorsey, or JD as he was often called, Miller asked Bob if he had a brother who sang. As it turned out, he did, sort of. I say sort of because Ray Eberle, Bob's younger brother, had never sung in a band before. But in spite of that, Miller signed Ray Eberle to a contract right away. Ray's often been criticized by people who consider his singing to be rather inferior and thin. In answer to those critics, Eberle often stated that Miller would often arrange the songs in a key that was just a little bit too high for Ray's singing range. Ray stayed with Glenn Miller and his orchestra until July of 1942. For many years, decades, rumors have had it that Miller fired Ray Eberle. One of the rumors says that Ray showed up late for a rehearsal one day, and Glenn just turned around and said, "You're fired," period, end of story. But Ray insisted throughout the rest of his life, and even his daughter, Jan Eberle, who leads a big band of her own now, insists that Glenn didn't fire Ray, that Ray quit because of money. And what's really complicates matters is once the two split up, Glenn Miller went to the trade papers and told them that he'd fired Ray.
Well, I'll tell you why I know that Glenn Miller never fired him, and it's because every time I think of Glenn Miller, it's inextricably linked with me with the film version of Glenn Miller's life. And let me tell you, Jimmy Stewart was just too nice a guy to fire anybody. So anyway, but here it goes. Was awful sweet. I like that quite a bit. Beautiful instruments, and I thought he did a pretty good job on that one. What about you, Ron?
Oh, I agree. I thought he did a good job as well. Not quite as good as his older brother, Bob, but he still did a fine job.
Well, you know what? Based on what you hear today pass for singing, you know, one of the things that always amazes me is a lot of times I'll be looking around for stuff to play on the show, and you know, I'll dig into some of these Capitol collections that I have and our old RCA discs, and you know, you'll see songs that you may have heard the song, but you're not familiar with the singer, and then you'll listen to it and you'll say, wow, you know, how did that person not have, you know, some phenomenal amount of success? And it just goes to the fact that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you talk to old timers about baseball. These guys were all very good. But, you know, then you had these standout singers, you know, the Sinatras and the Vera Lynns, and they get lost. You know, they just get lost, but they're there, and they had some great stuff, and it's a treat when you can listen to it.
Yes.
Well, we're going to finish up here with some Vaughn Monroe, and I like Vaughn Monroe quite a bit. Ghost Riders in the Sky is just, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the Bonanza gene in me or something. I don't know. I just, I really enjoy that, and yeah, if you want to give us a little background on this one, I'm going to cue this up here a little bit. We got to go back to another disc. And why don't you give us a little bit of info on Vaughn?
All right. Vaughn Monroe was born in Akron, Ohio in 1911. He learned how to play trumpet and later on the trombone. But Vaughn's main interest was singing. He actually had ambitions of becoming an opera singer, and that never quite worked out for him. However, he was hired as a vocalist for a few different regional big bands before he formed his own band in 1940. And one of his very first recordings spent 3 weeks at the number one position, a song called There I Go. And how often does someone just begin their recording career and right away get a number one song?
No, that's very unusual.
And, you know,
you go ahead, Ron.
Bob Monroe had a very unusual, a different voice, if you will. Not a bad voice at all. It's just somewhat different. Very macho, very masculine. For that reason, he earned nicknames such as the voice with hair on its chest.
Well, you know, depending on the composition, that might just be, you know, exactly what you need to put something over. And interesting that he was thinking about opera. You don't necessarily think of somebody, a big band leader, who would occasionally sing the song being into opera. Let's listen to Vaughn. Let's hear the voice with the hair on it.
Racing with the moon, high up in the midnight blue, and then fall too soon, it's lost from view.
If you know anybody who has a voice like that that I could book to come on the show and sing us a few songs, I would encourage anybody to drop us an email at tubetalk1@gmail.com. And I'd just like to remind you all, if you're tuning in, this is Tube Talk on WRCA, 1330 AM radio. You have found the zenith of independently produced good radio programming, and we're joined here tonight by Ron Ramirez, who is known for his prowess in the world of Philco Radio. Tonight he is sharing some of his big band favorites with us. And you know what, Ron? We are victims. We are victims of the clock here, where we have an hour for this program. So I'm going to make an executive decision, and the executive decision is we are going to do a separate segment on another show, because Ron has spent some time assembling his top 10 Philco list for us, or the 10 most wanted Philcos. And we're just not going to have any time here to begin to do that justice. So, Ron, I'd like to thank you for sharing your music and your knowledge about the big band era and having a seat in the parlor with us tonight. Next time you're on, we're going to pry you out of the rocking chair in the parlor. We're going to get you down to the radio room, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Philco, and we'll go through the top 10 list and have plenty of time to go over it and review it in the detail it deserves. So I appreciate you being on. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Paul. I've really enjoyed listening to the big band music with you and with the audience, and this is something I really enjoy, and perhaps at another time we can talk about the lady singers of the big bands.
Well, I'll tell you what, next time you're up in the Boston area, you come on by, and I'll plug the Stromberg Carlson in, and we'll do a little listening in the easy chair again. Thanks for being on. I appreciate it, Ron. Have a great night.
Thank you. You too, Paul.
Bye-bye. Thanks again for listening to Tube Talk on WRCA Radio. And I'd like to thank Ron again. That was a great night. Well, we had some hopes of getting to a section on Philco. Well, you know what? We had too much fun, and we'll finish up with some music tonight. And if you had some comments, anything you'd like to hear us play, any ideas for shows, things you'd like to hear us cover, anything related to the world of antique radio collecting or music that you might like to have a question on answered or have played for you, drop us an email. Our address is tubetalk1@gmail.com. I had to do this.
An old cowpoke been riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw. The ghost heard in the sky. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Ghost riders in the sky. Their faces gaunt, their eyes were blurred, and shirts all soaked with sweat. They're riding hard to catch that herd, but they ain't caught 'em yet. Cause they've got to ride forever on that range up in the sky. On horses snorting fire, as they ride on, hear their cry. Yibbe-yi-oh. Loped on by him, he heard one call his name. If you want to save your soul from hell, riding on our reins, then cowboy, change your ways today, or with us you will ride, a-trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies. Go.
and gentlemen, Vaughn Monroe. That was the number one song for 12 weeks starting in April of 1949, and that is one of my favorites. You know, that Vaughn Monroe, Riders in the Sky, some people will say I just watch too much Bonanza or Wagon Train, too many episodes of The Virginian, but, I really like that. And if you've ever been to Texas, I don't know, it sounds like the beginning of a joke, but if you ever have been to Texas and you've gone out into West Texas and you've looked at how big the sky is, you know, you could probably see something like that some night. And apparently the writer for that song was inspired. There's some mythical vision of a hunt that is in European mythology. And so that sort of inspired him to write that song. Anyway, we'd like to thank you for listening tonight, Ron and I. We hope to see you next week. This is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio. Have a great night.
Across the alley from the Alamo lived a pinto pony and a Navajo who sang a sort of Indian idaho to the people passing by. The pinto spent his time a-swishing flies, and the Navajo watched the lazy skies, and very rarely did they ever rest their eyes on the people passing by. One day they went a-walking along the railroad track. They were swishing, not a-looking, doot, doot. They never came back. Oh, across the alley from the Alamo, when the summer sun decides to settle low, a fly sings an Indian hearty-ho to the people passing by. Across the alley from the Alamo lived a pinto, a pony, and a Navajo who used to bake frijoles in cornmeal dough for the people passing by. They thought that they would make some easy bucks by washing their frijoles in dust and lux, a pair of very conscientious clucks to the people passing by. Then they took this cheap vacation. The shoes were polished bright. No, they never heard the whistle. Toot, toot. They're clear out of sight. Oh, across the alley from the Alamo, when the starlight beams its tender glow, the fiends go to sleep and then there ain't no dough for the people passing by. One day they went a-walking along the railroad track. They were swishing, not a-looking, toot, toot. They never came back. Oh, across the alley from the Alamo, when the summer sun decides to settle low, a fly sings an Indian hidey-ho to the people passing by. Across the alley